does whatever a spider can. Spins a web.
Hey, Owen, here we go. It is episode 149 of We Talk Comics. I'm your co-host, Keith, and I am joined by Chris.
Chris, yes, I am here, and I can't believe we've done 149 of these things.
Well, it always depends on how you count them.
Yeah, it seems like so much more we've done.
It's always a debate about whether an episode gets numbered or whether whether Mojo counted as part of the main run or not. Really, we leave this to our Wikipedia entry.
Oh, were Mojos? Did we actually call them the Mojo Show? The Mojo Show at the time, didn't it have some other name?
Mojo, I think had two episodes, and then Joe Mulvey got too big and didn't have as much time for us anymore. That's basically what happened there.
I thought it had a whole lot more episodes, but I didn't know it was actually called the.
Well, I trade waited after two, and then the deluxe edition never came together.
So. All I know is I was on one just because I said I didn't like Joe Mulvey's comic. Well, one of the most uncomfortable things we've ever done on the show, and we sang on one episode.
That's true. That was off. That was uncomfortable. I've debated a creator that I didn't like their work. So yeah, became a thing.
My problems were with the art, and not being an artist, I just did not know how to phrase it. Very uncomfortable.
Well, it's Joe Mulvey, so with a lot of profanity is how you should have worded it.
Should have. Yeah, I should have done it on there. I can do that.
That would have gotten your point across.
Well, a lot of people like Joe Mulvey's work. Go out, find Scam. Done some wonderful work for Comics Tribe. You should check out all of his books.
His new Kickstarter is just good.
No, I'm not on your side. So,
his new Kickstarter is so good. Mummy's already right on Kickstarter right now. We just a couple episodes ago we talked to Joe, and it is so cute. It's so funny.
Now you read a preview of that, didn't you?
I did. I did get a chance to read it. So this is going to be produced as a board book, so a children's book. And I did read a PDF of it, and it is hilarious. It's sweet. It's cute. I demanded Joe tell me who ghost wrote it for him, because it is so incredibly sweet and great, like really cute art too. It's about a little boy mummy and his mummy just a little adorable little Kickstarter. Definitely get on this one if it's still live when you hear this.
You know, if the kid doesn't buy second page with a real mummy or not a an Egyptian mummy.
An Egyptian mummy. They like they live inside a pyramid, and it's his mummy's advice to him for the day. It's really cute. And there's like a little pet spider that's in like I think on every page.
And I'm just saying that is also the premise of a horror movie. So
was there ever a horror movie about a baby mummy?
No, but there should have been.
Oh, that's like Chucky meets the
movie. Oh, man, I think you just made your million.
Oh, yeah, that's it right
there. Oh, write up a prospectus. Send it to Hollywood immediately.
I'm going to get on the ground floor of this whole Universal Monsters reboot.
Can you believe what they're doing with that? I mean, they are so dead set on having a Marvel-like universe that they're throwing the baby away with the bathwater.
But man, Universal Monsters was the original shared universe. They were doing a shared universe 60 years before Marvel came along.
Oh, yeah, but they need a good movie first.
I mean, that is fair that they didn't start to make a shared universe. They made a shared universe after a couple of them have been made, which is what I kept hoping DC would do that, you know, right after Batman Superman came out, they would just make an announcement. Oh, yeah, Green Lantern, that was part of it the whole time.
Yeah.
But we still have Ryan Reynolds on a on an option, and we're gonna enforce that. So Green Lantern back in. Yeah, Universal Monsters started. They did the original, you know, six or eight or whatever it was, and then after a couple of movies in, they started crossing those characters over and ended up with a shared universe.
Actually,
What was the first one that crossed over?
the first one was Frankenstein versus the Wolfman,
Nice.
which in Frankenstein chronologically is actually the fourth movie,
Right.
after Son of Frankenstein.
Because Frankenstein was the most bankable name, strangely. Like, I mean, you would you kind of you think of Dracula in hindsight, but you know there were six Frankenstein movies, right? Six, maybe seven.
Well, it depends. Once you get in the monster mashes, it gets very
Right.
confusing
Yeah,
because
whose movie is it?
you
Yeah.
have House of Frankenstein and House of Dracula,
Right.
but really, they're just the titular character is not the focus of either of those films. And Frankenstein deserves the credit because those are actually great films. I get a lot of crap from our buddy Mo because I don't actually like Dracula. I think it's a horrible film. The lack of a score hurts it so much. I mean, it has some iconic imagery, but the thing is damn long, or it feels that way.
It feels longer than it really is. I mean, it's probably 85 minutes. I mean, which for Universal was long. Might be 103 or something. I don't know. I don't completely disagree with you. I think it's more iconic than it is good.
I mean, you can sit anyone in front of Frankenstein or Bride of Frankenstein,
Yeah, they're
and
just
they're gonna
incredibly
like
well.
it.
They're just incredibly well-made movies. Yeah.
Same thing with the Invisible Man, who I don't think ever gets enough credit.
No, like Invisible. When I was in theater, Invisible Man was the one I wanted to do or see done. Like to do a stage version of the Invisible Man, I think would be really incredible.
Oh,
I
yeah,
don't.
it would. Although if you're going for the sequels, all the sequels are terrible.
Oh, they're awful.
Oh,
I think it's.
especially Secret Agent, Secret Man, which was the or oh, the one where he's a secret agent, which is the one I wanted to see because that makes the most sense.
There's what I have those amazing Universal movies box sets that came out when Van Helsing came out.
And I've been they came out with the Blu-rays, but they don't have all the special features and stuff, so.
No, and they don't have all the movies either. They just have like
No.
the main half dozen or eight. Like the original six plus Bride of Frankenstein and one more, I think, is all that got remastered.
Although I have to say the Creature of the Black Lagoon DVDs in that set are kind of disappointing. Because you only get the three movies. In the rest of the packs, I think you get six.
Yeah, well, it depends on the series. It's five or six for all of them. Black Lagoon, they're only worth three. Invisible Man, I think, is four, maybe five. One of the Invisible Mans is really kind of thin, as far as tying it together. I mean, the Mummy and Frankenstein had the most because I think they had six each.
Yeah, and actually, the Dracula ones, there are some very, to call the movies on those sequels is really stretching it.
Well, the cool part of the Dracula box set is it has the Spanish version,
Yeah,
which,
which actually is a better movie.
yeah, it's a cool artifact. I mean, for those who don't know, it's when they filmed Dracula, the Bela Lugosi Dracula, they would film the American film during the day, and then at night, using exactly the same sets, they would film a second version of Dracula in Spanish with a completely different cast. So they filmed these like the same like day for day basically.
Oh,
But it's not the
and I
same but it's not
mean,
the same director and it's not the same same script exactly. So it there's variation in it too.
but it's the same costumes, which is hilarious, except for some of the women's costumes who are more scantily clad in the Spanish version. And one of the shots in Dracula drives me up the wall, always has, even as a kid, are the armadillos. when they just flash over the armadillos and you watch the Spanish version and it's rats. Somehow armadillos were somehow more acceptable to have creeping around a castle in 1930, 31, than rats. But they had the rats there if they wanted to use them.
I tell
That's
you,
absolutely bizarre.
the Hays Code was weird. Weird, weird
But the
stuff.
Hays Code wasn't being enforced to that point.
Is that it? Yeah, we're not on We Talk Movies, so that's
No, no, no.
I can be wrong about my Hays Code chronology. So it's a big week. We're counting down to DC's Rebirth. I have been offline since Friday. Chris, what did I text you, and then what did you text me back on Friday?
You texted me, going offline. The spoilers are all already, or the spoilers are coming. And not 10 minutes later, I went online for something else, and my news feed was plugged, absolutely plugged with Rebirth this, Rebirth that, and I had to just sort of shut it back off. And I texted you just thanking you because I would have. I mean, there was clickbait there, and I would have pressed it if you hadn't given me a warning, man. Because I thought it was so early for the spoilers already to be out there.
Yeah, I had it was editor of Comicosity, Matt Satori Griffith had sent me a message on Twitter and just said, like, if you want to dodge him, you've got to go now. Like, he said, I've read it. That means reviewers have read it, and it's your enjoyment in your own hands at this point. So I have not opened Twitter since Friday night. What I do in these situations is I just flip on the notifications and then leave it. So if anyone needs to get me, but it turned out it was a holiday weekend, so like I got two tweets the entire weekend.
Don't you remember a time when you could read a review safely before you read the comic or saw the movie? And now it's all out there even before, so you have to go into total shutdown. It's really kind of a pain.
The stuff was out there. I think maybe the difference is that it's harder to avoid now, and it's going to be everywhere. And I think the biggest thing for me is you're going to see it over and over. So it's not like, it's not like when you would see a movie trailer at a movie and then a year later see the movie. You're going to see that movie trailer, and then you're going to see 80 TV ads that recycle that footage. You're going to have watched the trailer 5 times because it's on YouTube and we have poor impulse control. But I was watching a James Bond. I was watching a whole bunch of James Bonds recently, and I watched the trailer for Dr. No, which is the first James Bond film. And the trailer for Dr. No in 2 minutes is a summary of the movie, including the final shot of the movie. It is actually scenes for the film in order for 2 minutes. That was the original trailer for it. So, it's always been there, but you would watch that in the theater once, and then, 6 months later or whatever, actually go back and see the movie.
Oh, we're gonna get back on the movies thing, but wasn't Thunderball the first James Bond film? Okay.
No, Dr. No was the first film.
Okay, I'm
Thunderball
gonna
was
have to go back.
third or
It's a
fourth.
pleasure going back, but.
Third or fourth. I did a an I did a well, interesting to me experiment. I mean, it won't be interesting to anyone else, but I'm going to talk about it on the podcast anyway. I did an interesting experiment where I was listening to all of the James Bond novels as audiobooks, which was quite enjoyable. I found this series that had famous like British actors, like Bill Nighy did one, and Tom Hid and Hiddleston did one. Some really interesting British actors reading
Now,
all these
these are
books.
the Ian Fleming ones, right?
Correct, yeah, the Ian Fleming. So I went through listening by audiobook the entire series of Ian Fleming's in order, and then I would watch the films in the order the novels came out, which is not even close to the order the films come out. Because Live and Let Die is the first or second, and Moonraker is quite is f like fifth or something like that. So they're a totally different order than the films were.
Now, I've never gone back and read any of the novels. I think I tried one and I just didn't like how Ian Fleming put things. Do most of the older movies actually have Ian Fleming adaptations or vice versa? Are they actually based on the books? And I actually thought the movie creation was just sort of spun out of the book and never looked back.
Looser as it goes on. Some of them are quite close. From Russia with Love, for example, is really close to the novel. While others, like Moonraker, is very different. I mean, Moonraker, obviously, the film is with space shuttles, which is wasn't even dreamt of when Fleming wrote the original novel. So some of them are close, some of them vary widely. The Spy Who Loved Me has no relation to the film at all. The novel is Fleming was so unhappy with the novel after it was published that he refused to give the rights to the story. The film is only the name. They were allowed to use the name, but not any plot element from the
And
novel.
actually, that's one of my favorite James Bond films, so.
I think it's probably more like it's probably my favorite of Moore's. I was always drawn to more of the spy ones. Like R From Russia with Love is my favorite James Bond film, because it is more of a pure spy story. Like it's to me, it's the great Cold War James Bond story that they didn't do anywhere else. Everything else is gadgets or, goofiness. It's the one that is it is like and also the one closest to the original novel.
Okay, we're back on a
We're
tangent here,
drifting,
but finish,
drifting
finish,
widely.
fin
Wildly.
yeah, we're
I like
drifting
that,
wide.
but I will say that 17 minutes into the episode, I haven't said the name of the episode, which, Brett hates when I do that. And from everything you've heard so far, it should be obvious that the name of the episode is Expo Aftermath.
Yes.
These are we're a couple of weeks past the Calgary Comic and Entertainment Expo, the 11th year of the Expo, and always a fun show. Chris, glad you could make it into town to enjoy the show. We recorded some panels there. You'll hear those on the podcast coming up soon. I moderated a panel with Ryan Ferrier and an artist named Rove about a comic called Terminals, which is now on Comixology.
Yes,
And
actually, but Rove is actually credited under his real name.
yeah, it's both. He's credited as both in those books, which is strange. Trevor James, the Rove is his art name. He's not a comic artist by trade. He is a tattoo artist by trade. So
Which
Terminals was his.
actually, I haven't. I've been saving Terminals for a time that I actually have time because. I love Ryan Ferrier's work, and I actually don't like to just breeze through it. I need to sit down and actually pay attention to what I'm doing, so I've been saving it, but I can't wait to see how Rove's art translates between the tattoo artist and how the tattoo artist affects the comic book art. I think it's going to be actually quite a fascinating journey.
Well, an interesting, I mean, it was an interesting discussion because Terminals is the first work that either of them had done in comics 7 years ago, and Ryan, of course, has gone on to some fantastic work, Dave and Sons of Anarchy, so many great books that he's done, and now he's coming back after all that time, having, done work for a whole bunch of different publishers, a whole bunch of different genres. He's even done some Marvel work, and he's going back to that world. Rove, on the other hand, did that work and then went full-time tattooing and hasn't returned to comics. So his art style has developed through a completely different medium. So it is, yeah, it was an interesting discussion and interesting to look at these comics. I mean, the Terminals Volume 1 is very much an early work by creators who are figuring out how the medium works as far as creativity goes.
Yeah, but it stars a bear, so you can
it
forgive
does have
a lot.
It does have a bear in it. Yeah, there's the, yeah. it does have a sentient bear, so that's not bad. And then the second volume is standalone stories. They're one shots in that same universe. So, yeah, it's an interesting from an arts from a creative standpoint. It's interesting what they've done.
And as long as we're hyping it, it's coming up from Boom, or it's out from Boom, right?
It's not Boom. It is Penny Farthing is the name of the company.
Oh, my bad. Penny Farthing.
That's all right. Yeah, Penny Farthing is... they commissioned the work and came to them all these years later and said, we would like some more now. But yeah,
you can grab that on. So highlights of the con for you.
Well, it was an interesting convention because the official numbers say that the convention was not down, but it felt quieter. Saturday felt crazy, as Saturday
but
always is.
That's Saturday. It's con Saturday.
The rest of the show felt a little thinner. I don't know whether it was. Right now we're in an economic downturn. We're in Calgary. This is Calgary Expo, and there is quite a downturn in the economy in the city, so there's not as much money floating around as there has been for this show previously. So I think that'll affect it. I think talking to retailers and people selling things, there was a lot of talk that if you had new stuff and low ticket prices, then you were having a good weekend. If you were selling high-end stuff, it was a little rough. For me, I had a great time. I always have a great time at these shows. Now we know so many people that it's like old home week when we go.
Oh, it is so weird going to these cons that, before, you'd spend an hour lining up or something like that. And now that we've talked to most of these people and they know us, it's just smiles come as soon as they see you coming down the aisle and like that. It's such a rewarding experience, and everybody in comics seems so nice now.
We've just some really great, great experiences and great people. It's really cool to go through Artist Alley, and now there's a lot of these folks we only see at the conventions. Some of them from out of town. Vic Malhotra is from Edmonton, so we see him basically just at the conventions. We get a chance to visit with these folks and, share that moment. We spend the whole weekend just doing nothing but talking about comics. It's amazing.
And Vic is such a nice guy, but to tell you the truth, I don't know. Do you know if he's working on anything right now?
Roche Limit was the last thing that he was on.
Okay, I have that. I have that signed. I have that digitally. I have a hardcover around here, I think.
I don't know what he's up to right now. I only saw him for a couple of minutes because he was he came into Ryan's panel.
I was there too. So
yeah, a great time because some good shopping. I got some good deals. I'm getting a little pickier about my trade collections because I'm running out of shelf space. So
yeah, that is the problem.
I did find a copy of the Treasury oversized Superman Fantastic Four though, which I've wanted for ages. The giant treasury, right? Which
that's,
I got for
that's the rarest of the treasuries, I think.
I got it for like $5 or something. It was this is the danger.
But then how do you store it?
I have no idea. It's bigger than an absolute. It's taller than an absolute edition. I have no idea where this thing's gonna go.
And it's thinner, so it doesn't stand up on the shelf.
That's right. Yeah, I don't think I have a shelf big enough to hold it. Maybe there's one work by Seth that may be that tall, so I'll just stick it next to that so it doesn't get hurt. There's a Seth hardcover that's probably that big.
Comics from this era, and especially those crossovers, I have to ask: is it readable?
Oh, well, this is the newer one. Well, newer being done in the 90s.
Oh, then, okay. My bad. Okay.
Yeah, this is like, Dan Jurgens wrote it.
Okay. Good.
94, 96, something like that. I don't know that I've actually read it. to be honest. I tuned out of DC for quite a long time. And so there's kind of a hole that I've just gone back and filled in. So yeah, I don't, whether I borrowed it from someone at some point or have not read it at all.
Well, I just picked up Dan Jurgens' entire run on Captain America. So I'm going to have some questions when next we speak to him. Because we've ignored his Marvel work. So
yeah,
in fact, when Brett was on with him, he forgot that Dan Jurgens ever worked for Marvel, which was kind of humorous.
I think we've had Dan on a couple of times, and I think all we've talked to him about was we briefly talked about his Spider-Man run. His very, very brief Spider-Man run.
I remember his Spider-Man run, and it wasn't...
It was brief.
Yes, it was brief, maybe for a reason.
I think that's, yeah, that's the extent. Because I've not read his Thor. Thor and Captain America made up the bulk of his time there. I read some of the Captain America.
It's like you're paying attention to what I'm buying digitally, because I do. Marvel, actually, right now, if you use... I can find this code nowhere else. This week, I think until June 5th, you can pick up the Walt Simonson Visionaries run for 75% off with the code WALT.
Oh, neat.
So that's $5 a book.
Well, that's a cool run, too.
A cool run, too. I really shouldn't have splurged, but...
Yeah, I'm doing quite a bit of splurging. We were talking before we started the episode record about Rebirth. So Rebirth is on Wednesday this week. We're recording this before Rebirth has come out. We're dodging spoilers as best we can. I have also been told that apparently DC has not helped the spoiler thing by just releasing press releases that have all of the details. So I will not be online until Wednesday morning. But I've hit pre-order on, I try to hold off a couple of months for most things to get that price drop. But I've hit pre-order on Justice League, Lois and Clark number 8, which was going to happen anyway. The final chapter of Super League and Rebirth. My understanding is that at least Justice League and Super League you should read before Rebirth.
Hmm. Really, it's odd that they don't have like a reading order or something like that, or time delay.
Well,
because I would, if you hadn't just told me, I would have jumped right into Rebirth.
Well, I mean, it does. I don't think Rebirth's going to be not understandable. If you're following one of those runs now, you should read it before. If you're not, I wouldn't worry about it. If you're not reading Justice League at this point, if you haven't been reading Darkseid War, then don't worry about it. But the ending of Darkseid War is going to be a finished thing in Rebirth number one. So Rebirth will spoiler the end of those if you're currently reading them.
Now, this also marks the end of a lot of runs.
It does.
What books are you losing off your pull list?
Honestly, not a huge amount. I mean, I quietly dropped a lot of DC over the past year, and I think I'm not inclined to talk about the stuff I'm not enjoying. So I wasn't advertising it, but I dropped a lot. I mean, Lois and Clark is ending so that Dan Jurgens can take over on Action, which is going to be great. I've been getting a couple of the Superman books, so I'll actually probably be up a issue or two a month, because Superman and Action are both bi-weekly. I hadn't been getting any Batmans. Grayson I'll lose. Grayson also ends this week.
Actually, I don't even count that as a cancellation, because, I mean, the same writer, artists are moving on to Nightwing. So
Yeah, and they've
It's going to
actually
be different, but I.
they've already exited Grayson as well. Like the last three issues of Grayson aren't by those creators. They've already moved on to Rebirth.
Okay, so yeah, that's. I don't. Any plot threads left we could follow up. And the whole spy motif was, although very interesting, I thought it was sort of winding down anyway, so.
Yeah, Midnighter I think is would be the big loss for me, because
I
Midnighter
would have
doesn't
said
have.
Justice League 3001 for you, actually.
I kind of cooled on it to be honest. I was huge into it, and then this last arc hasn't been wowing me. Really kind of since Porter left, and they dropped the, I mean Booster and Beetle have stopped appearing in it, and
It's
Howard
still
Porter's
Keith
moved over,
Giffen, though,
so.
so.
Yeah, it hasn't grabbed me the last few issues. So I don't. I mean, it's ending. I'll finish out the run. I probably would have been thinking about dropping it if it was continuing very much longer.
And I'm going to miss the Secret Six.
Yeah.
I really love that book, and I mean, I just love Ralph Dibby, so, and I don't know where he's going to fit into the new Rebirth scheme, so.
Yeah, that was quite a surprise that they slid him into that book. Yeah, most of the stuff I'm getting is going to continue in some variation. Like Batman Beyond gets a rebirth. Like I said, Superman in action.
And you could say actually it's a promotion for Dan Jurgens to move from Lois Clark to a Superman book.
Oh yeah, for sure. I
Like this
action's
is the
going to be.
main deal. I had a friend actually said he wanted to get into comics, and the first book he bought was the first volume of New 52 Action.
Oh,
And I was oh,
the
oh.
George Perez run, which
Yeah, and it was
so
like,
art wise
can you return
beautiful.
it?
Art wise beautiful.
I have some Superman stories for you if that's what you need.
A troubled run.
Oh.
I
And
read a
then he's
new,
well, I got the
yeah.
Superman too, and it was, well, that's better, but it's Grant Morrison.
Oh, the action.
Yeah, you
Yeah.
got the yeah, I don't know. I didn't like any of
Yeah,
that
well,
initial
Morrison
stuff.
was writing action, and George Perez was doing Superman. So whichever
Correct.
one was going to be right. I'm not a fan of Grant Morrison's action run from the New 52.
No, well, that any of those continuity things, and
I
it's
think,
just not, I don't
yeah.
think it's and it neither of those, but although both readable, I think they're both not, they shouldn't be somebody's introduction.
No. I was thinking the other day that Superman's a tricky one to recommend books for, because if you look at the list of the greatest Superman stories ever told, they're either origins or final stories. There's not a lot of like Superman, he's Superman at the beginning of the story and he's Superman at the end of the story. There's a lot of stuff, there's a Man of Steel, Birthright, Secret Origins, and there's a lot of Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow and All Star of Superman, which are all ending stories. So it's a tricky one to actually find a like. There's tons of Batman is Batman at the beginning and the end of the story. There's not a lot of Supermans for that
For
are
some
like.
reason, I didn't think you'd include All-Star Superman, because I thought I was the only one of our immediate circle that really likes All-Star Superman.
Oh, I really like All Star Superman. I can't stand Birthright.
Okay.
Birthright, I've never made it to the end of. I think I really, really dislike
Wow, actually we do actually agree on that all, because
it.
I mean, we're getting into weird territory because, I mean, Birthright is a well-respected story.
It is. I.
I always thought it was.
I've, it is very well respected, and it is I've it is a big separator of how you see that character for sure, because it's very much a Silver Age, schmaltzy, sentimental take on that character, which and some people obviously really like a sentimental take on that character. I'm not one of them. I prefer more grounded, the Superman who thinks of himself as human take on the character. So different takes for different people.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, we should talk about, some of more con things, I suppose.
Absolutely.
Did you talk to anybody at the con?
I did get a couple of interviews in at the show. Hopefully there's some folks that we spoke to that we'll be able to have on the show later. There were some people that we weren't able to talk to while we were there, but we got to meet some really fun folks. Met Ryan Stegman, who's a really great dude. And I know Brett and Mo were trying to line up some interviews as well. So there's some folks I hope we can get on later. Ray Fox was not feeling up to an interview. I've gotten a chance to talk to him the last couple of expos. So hopefully we'll be able to speak to him soon too. But I did get a couple interviews recorded. Why don't we kick off with Canadian treasure Jim Zub. Jim is he's the writer on Thunderbolts from Marvel, as well as a ton of other stuff. So we get into some of the other things. The focus of our interview is Thunderbolts, but also we cover some of the creator-owned work he's doing as well.
Now, did he tell you when Troll Girl appears?
See, now that's why it's important that you give me question notes before I do these interviews.
I asked that to him myself. He won't tell me.
Because all of my questions were about when General Ross was going to reappear, and he just gave me kind of some attitude. Some people like a more sentimental version of the Thunderbolts, and some people, like myself, like a more grounded one, where everyone's dressed in black and red.
Yeah, where everyone's dressed in black.
And the Punisher's dating Elektra. That's the version I dig. And I know different takes for different people. All right, let's go to that interview with Jim.
So how are you?
I'm doing great.
Good.
It's been a little while since we talked.
Yeah.
All of the books got announced.
Yeah, doing a ton of stuff right now. It's good. So on my slate, I guess, is, I guess, it is.
I hope.
As far as I'm aware, I'm doing the following projects. So I do Wayward at Image, my ongoing creator-owned series. I've got a new creator-owned series launching at the end of the summer called Glitter Bomb. I'm doing the official Dungeons & Dragons comic for IDW and Thunderbolts for Marvel, and then the Street Fighter Cammy miniseries for Udon. So other than that, nothing. Pretty bored.
All over the place.
Yeah, staying out of trouble.
So Thunderbolts, number one, will be out when this episode airs.
Yeah.
Give a pitch for Thunderbolts.
So Thunderbolts, in the classic Thunderbolts vein, it's about... either good people doing bad things or bad people trying to do good things and failing miserably at it. So it's a sort of heroic villainy, if you will. So there's a team of morally bankrupt, characters who are trying to redeem themselves, or are they? And that's really kind of where we're at. So the new team is comprised of quite a few of the original members. So you've got Moonstone, you've got the Fixer, you've got Mach 10, and and Atlas. But now the team is being led by the Winter Soldier. And there's an addition of a character from Standoff called Kobik, who adds into the team and adds a lot of drama to the dynamic. We'll wait for that. We'll cut this in post.
Join us for conversational Klingon and learn how to speak with honor.
Could that be more cliche? That's amazing.
FG room, and we're going to have some special news to share too.
Goodness.
Got
Maybe you want to
so we didn't,
in,
we didn't say off the top right. That we're at a comic convention.
By the way, we're at a comic convention. That wasn't just like a grocery store announcement about casual Klingon.
special in aisle 3, casual Klingon.
Right.
So, what? Looking back over the, did you go back over the various
I did.
Incarnations of Thunderbolts?
I went hardcore. So Tom Brevoort, who's the Avengers managing editor, he recommended certain issues I should read, and I thought, well, I'm crazy enough. I went back and I read everything. So I read 250 issues of Thunderbolts and Dark Avengers put together, and I had a little notepad. and I literally just wrote things down, wrote down little plot lines, wrote down character moments or things that I liked about the dynamic, just to help, not that I wanted to copy, but I wanted to just understand and see how the pieces fit together well. And so that the series is built so that you can pick up issue one and you can read forward and there's no problem. But if you've been a longtime Thunderbolts fan, if you've enjoyed these characters, they are the same characters. It is their continuing story. They won't act like they're not going to act like they've never met people that they've met before. You know what I mean? Right. Like continuity, that's the way I look at continuity. You have to move the ball forward and you have to create something where there's a good jumping on point. But that doesn't mean you forget all of history. You just have to use it sparingly, or when you use it, make sure that a current reader understands why this is important.
Right.
So I wanted to have that knowledge. So I kind of filled my brain to the brim with all Thunderbolts all the time. And it was really cool. It was really cool seeing the multiple iterations of the team, seeing some really seminal runs from some great creative teams, and kind of realizing kind of the legacy that we were taking on. And getting a little more scared than I was when I accepted the gig. But no, in a good way. Like, realizing there's a lot of passionate people who love the Thunderbolts for a lot of good reasons, because it's a great comic. So hopefully I will continue said legacy of greatness. Yeah.
Was there a particular run or an iteration that kind of like stopped you and like, oh yeah, that's where it hit it?
Like, I mean, there's multiple times. I think there's three or four of those. I mean, Kurt, you know, Busiek right off the bat did a great job launching the book, setting up the character dynamics and really building something cool. So you can't talk about Thunderbolts without Kurt's original run, because that's just why it works so well. But later on, I think Jeff Parker's is probably the most consistently fun. Like, Jeff did this just killer run with weird characters coming out of the woodwork and bizarre dynamics, and it was always action-packed and amusing. And I'm like, I don't want to ape what he's doing, but I want to have a smile on my face when I finish an issue like you did when you read some of his. Yeah.
So. Now, tell us about the new Image book.
So, Glitter Bomb is Hollywood horror. It's sort of like a nasty, sarcastic takedown of our obsession with fame and Hollywood. And so it's about an actress who's at what they call the invisible age, where when you're young and you're hot and you're the it girl in Hollywood, you can get lots of roles because you are beautiful or because you are skilled and beautiful. And then when you're really old, you can play a grandma or something. But in between, if you're middle-aged, there is no work for you all of a sudden.
Right.
So, you know, male co-stars can be 50, 60 years old and their female co-stars are 20, right? And so this, like, 45-year-old woman, she was a TV actress. She was very capable. And all of a sudden, you know, things have dried up. She's had some bad turns. She's a single mom now. She's trying to raise a kid. She's trying to get her next gig off the ground, and it's not happening. And all of her frustration and all of her rage kind of bubbles underneath and becomes something nasty. Let's put it that way. Something horrible from beyond takes advantage of her emotional state and decides it's going to tear a strip off Hollywood.
So. And when's that hit shelves?
So that should be first week of September.
Okay.
And we've already got four issues done. We are cranking on it. We're really, really happy with how it's going. The artist and co-creator on it is a gentleman named Jabril Morissette, and he's from Montreal, and he's one of the most skilled young artists I have ever met. He's 21, and he draws like a veteran. His storytelling is immaculate. His brushwork is just, it's killer. I've rarely seen someone so fully formed at his age, and feels mature, feels like a veteran in terms of the choices he makes, his storytelling choices, his expressions, the way he puts it all on the paper. He's going to be a knockout, and I feel incredibly fortunate that I'm able to work with him and kind of, for lack of a better term, kind of launch him into the business. So,
that's fantastic.
Yeah, very cool.
All right. Well, Wayward on shelves,
yep.
Thunderbolts on shelves.
Yeah.
Glitter Bomb coming soon.
Yeah, and Dungeons & Dragons also launching by the time both Dungeons & Dragons and Thunderbolts launch the same day. So by the time the podcast goes up, people can get Dungeons & Dragons Shadows of the Vampire #1 and Thunderbolts.
Fantastic.
And good times. Sweet.
Thanks a lot, Jim.
Thank you.
All right, thanks again to Jim Zub for talking to us at the expo. And get all of the books that he mentioned. Chris, have you had a chance to read Thunderbolts yet?
I'm actually waiting for a run, because I read the initial Thunderbolts. I think I read issue 1 to 144 over 1 weekend.
So I'll send a note to Jim that you're ready to buy when he gets 144.
Yeah, don't do that. I'll do a trade by trade now, but he needs 6 issues out before I'll buy. Which is sad to say, but I own the issues. I just haven't looked at them yet.
Well, sight unseen. What do you think of the inclusion of Winter Soldier in the Thunderbolts?
I love it. I love it, especially since one of the mainstays of the original series was the interchangeable leader.
Mm.
I mean, you start out with Zemo. You have Luke Cage leading the team for a while. You have Hawkeye leading the team for a while. It's one of those teams that the leader doesn't really matter. It's about the team dynamic. And the team, for the most of the run, stays consistent, which I find fascinating. Basically because nobody else in the Marvel Universe wanted to use any of those characters. So Marvel would try to goose sales by replacing the leader. So, you know, Winter Soldier, that works for me. I look forward to next month when Falcon's the leader.
So what's the deal with when Falcon became Captain America, he also became leader of the Avengers?
I've read Captain America and the Mighty Avengers, I think it was called, and the Avengers.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It was very weird how all of a sudden he got a promotion. Yeah, no, I have troubles with that run because it also happened, I think it was during Fear that, where all the Avengers went evil, and that was your issue 1 where everybody was evil, so it was very confusing just to jump on.
That's, you described any Marvel book of the last 10 years.
I'm actually getting right back into Marvel, to tell you the truth. They've got a lot of interesting books.
I think
Devil Dinosaur and Moon Girl is really kind of a bizarre book. Of course, Squirrel Girl, all the Spider Women stuff. And there's about 4 titles out there with Silk and Spider Gwen and Spider Woman herself.
Oh, for good things about Spider Gwen, yeah.
So it's really a interesting time. Hellcat also is a very interesting title. So I'm reading a whole bunch of Marvel, which I haven't been able to say in the past.
Oh, groovy. Well, it is certainly something for. I've always thought Marvel and DC is the downside of the interconnectedness is, you know, obviously it's difficult to get into. The upside is that it rewards loyalty, and the more you read, the more it's rewarding by telling this, you know, broader scoping story. It's the double-edged sword of company-wide continuity. The same for Valiant, of course. Hard to follow one Valiant book, but if you're following them all, you're getting this, you know, intricate latticework of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I've been doing fine with Valiant. Of course, I buy all the books with the exception of Ninjak. So
that's fair. Yeah, you'll be okay until next year's Ninjak crossover.
Yes,
Ninjak and the Iron Marines.
So did you talk to anyone else at the con? Maybe with Thunderbolts connection.
Well, I did talk to another writer, not a Canadian, but I won't hold that against him.
Oh, I think we should.
Well, I don't want to hold it against him because he doesn't even have to have a lawyer on retainer. He can handle his own legal counsel. So I'm careful what I say about Charles Soule.
Although I don't think the political satire in Letter 44 would be quite as crisp if he was an outsider. So maybe we can forgive him for not being a Canadian. Maybe.
All right. Well, let's go now to my interview with Charles Soule.
Okay, so we are at the Calgary Comic and Entertainment Expo. We're on the last day, so how's the show been going for you?
It has been a wonderful show. This is my first time at the Calgary Expo. I have done Toronto shows, but this is my first time sort of in the western part of Canada, and I love it. The fans are amazing. It's been very busy. I've been treated really well, and it's no complaints whatsoever.
Fantastic. So you're Marvel exclusive now?
Yes.
Big time.
But I guess so. You say so.
But you do. You've kept your hand in with one creator owned book.
Yes. Yes.
Now, Letter 44.
Yep.
Been running for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
Give the pitch for those who aren't familiar with it.
Sure. Absolutely. So Letter 44 is a book about a U.S. president. Who gets elected. On his first day, he goes to the Oval Office and reads the secret letter from the previous president that only he's allowed to read. And that letter says, "Hey man, good luck. Being president's a huge pain in the ass. It's a very tough job. And it's going to be especially hard for you because we found this alien construction project in the asteroid belt 7 years ago and didn't tell anybody about it. So surprise, that's your problem now. P.S. We sent up a manned mission to sort of make contact and see what they're doing up there. You got to try and take care of them too. They're all heroes." So the story from there has two tracks. One is the president down on Earth trying to decide what he's going to do about this revelation, and the other is about the astronauts in space getting closer and closer to finding out the truth of what this thing is that's being built up there. So it's this big epic space opera, if you will. It's gotten out to issue 25 so far on the shelves, three collections. It'll go to six collections when it's all done, issue 35, and I'm very proud of it. The artist is Alberto Jimenez Albuquerque. He's drawn almost every issue, and it's really starting to pick up steam now, which is great. I'm just talking a lot about it, but it's a series that I like, and
that's why I wanted to talk to you about it, because I know it's a passion project.
It is. It was nominated selected at Angoulême this past January as one of the best publication of the French language in the last year, because it's been starting to be published in other countries, and it's been really gratifying that it's something Alberto and I have been working on for 2.5 years, and it seems now that with the third trade being out, people are really finding it, and it's reached critical mass, so most people are talking about it in a big way. So it feels great. It feels like a great time to be writing Letter 44 and presumably to be reading it.
And it's a nice, quiet, thoughtful book, having just finished World War III.
Yes, yep, that's true. World War III finished up in the third volume. The fourth volume is going to be entitled Saviors, which almost sort of, I mean, you can't go much bigger than World War III, although we sort of do, but it almost takes it to a very personal level, looks at a whole bunch of the different characters in the book and how they all feel like they're going to individually save the world in one way or another. And some of those goals are in conflict with one another, and it's really neat to have a series that I can sort of talk about whatever subject I want to talk about within the larger context of this story. So talks about it, you know, the fourth volume is kind of about issues of faith and belief and how far those beliefs can push you to do things that might be a little extreme if you believe you're in the right, things like that. I'm having a blast with it, what can I say?
And you draw from a little bit of kind of real mythology, of real parts, like the letter 44 itself.
Yes.
Tell people what the history of that is in the real world.
Sure. So ever since Ronald Reagan, the outgoing president has left a secret letter on the desk of the incoming president, which only that incoming president is allowed to read, and so no one knows what's in them. Presumably, it's reflections on, you know, what it's like to be president, the things to watch out for, the things to think about, the things to focus on in your upcoming administration. But it also could be, as far as we know, surprise, there are aliens living under Montana, or anything. It could be anything at all. We don't know. And so that, I thought, was a very potent, very American mythology that I liked a lot. The other mythology that I've been working with a lot in the series is space travel. I think space travel is certainly not only an American thing, but it began as, in part, as an American thing, an American and a Soviet thing, with the original space race. And I think it's something that, it's getting better now, but when I started writing the series, my original inspiration was the last space shuttle launch, the last American space shuttle launch, which I thought was so kind of sad, the fact that we didn't have a ship that was going up to orbit.
Yeah.
anymore with any regularity. And so I was inspired to think of what would get us out there again in a big way, what would get us exploring again in a big way. And I thought if we found aliens, we would probably send something up to make contact. But I just, I like writing about, I mean, I think astronauts and the engineers and the scientists behind the actual space program are brilliant and amazing in so many different ways. I've been privileged to meet some of them through this book being out in the world, and they're like serious superhero types, and it's really cool.
So for the crew on the ship, what's the name of the ship?
The Clark. Yeah, the story is very inspired by the stories of Arthur C. Clarke, 2001 and things like that. So there's a lot of little nods to particularly 2001 all over the place, but other ones as well.
So at the time that Letter 44 starts, how long has the Clark been in space?
About 3 years, which is a little longer than it would probably take to get up to the asteroid belt in an optimal, you know, launch configuration, but they didn't. The conceit is that they didn't have it, and they had to go as quickly as they could, and so they took a not great launch window, and it took them a little longer to get out there. So they've been in space for about 3 years.
And 3 years is a long time for people to be locked in a can.
No doubt about it.
So what's life been like for them?
Well, I mean, some of that is we're exploring in the current arc, which is fun. But basically, they've had there's nine of them when the story begins. Let me rephrase that. There were nine of them when the mission launched. There are eight of them when the story begins, which is interesting. And that's a story that you actually will learn more about in the fourth volume. Why there's only eight as opposed to nine when we pick up at the beginning. But they have had to make decisions that will allow them to survive psychologically, in particular, on a mission this long. And one of the things that they've done, there's two women and seven men, one of whom is gay, and they kind of have to put aside a lot of the rules about typical human relationships on Earth that have the luxury of lots of partners and lots of choice and things like that. So the rules that they come up with are basically you can ask anybody to do anything you want, you can't, but nobody can have a claim on anybody, and if they say no, they say no. And that leads to sort of it's not a typical like polyamorous society really, but it kind of is, and it's a way for them to address the needs, the obvious needs that they're going to have on a length of time that long. And then it leads to one of the characters getting pregnant, which is where we pick up the sort of story. One of them is pregnant with a baby, who becomes a big part of the story as things go on.
So where do we go from here? What's the tease for the next couple of issues?
Sure. So in the book right now, World War III has just ended I don't want to talk too much about the sides and things like that because it will sort of spoil things a little bit, but World War III ended in a way that was perhaps not super great for the United States. It was very complicated. It seems like the idea that World War III was this big worldwide crisis is quickly paling in comparison to the actual answering the question of why the aliens are here in our solar system. The concerns and squabbles of petty humanity are paling in comparison to the real threat that's coming. Volume 4, which we're about halfway through now, is really concerned with answering the big questions about why the aliens came to our solar system, what they're trying to do, what they're trying to stop, what they're trying to help, and what it's going to mean for the human race. So the next issue that's going to be out is, I think 25 is not quite out yet, but will be soon. And then 26 is where you finally get the answer to that question, and 27 is where you get how we react to it, how humanity reacts to the answers to some of those big questions, which I think it's weird to be like pulling the trigger on some of this stuff, because these have been questions I've been having in the back of my mind now for years, and now you guys will all know some of the things that I've known for a long time, which is pretty neat. So it's fun to be pulling the curtain back, but it's sad in a way too, because once those curtains are pulled back, then we're on rails as we go into the last arc, which will sort of end the story, and lots of amazing things will happen. It'll be crazy.
How long has this been living in your head then?
Well, I didn't have everything when I came up with the concept, but I had it fairly soon after. So I would say I've had the broad and even many of the detailed strokes of the story since around issue 6. So I've kind of known what I was going to do since then. Somewhere in one of my notebooks, I have like the whole breakdown of everything. And I've stuck pretty close to it because I was happy with it then. It certainly evolved as any project does, but I... the ending I'm going to write with issue 35 is pretty much what I always planned to do. So I hope people like it. We'll see.
Fantastic. And outside of Letter 44, what can folks be looking for?
Well, I'm writing the Poe Dameron series for Marvel, which is the from Star Wars Episode 7, the Oscar Isaac character, which is very fun to write. Issue 2 of that.
Some people may be familiar with that character.
Yes, maybe one or two. My Twitter is full of Poe Dameron these days. So Issue 1 was out about a month ago. Issue 2 is out on Wednesday, May 4th. May the 4th be with you, which is pretty great.
My birthday.
That's great. That's why I did it, for you. Great birthday.
It's for me. Thank you. I appreciate
that. I'm writing a run on Daredevil that just saw Issue 6 come out. Issue 7 is out soon, both of which star Elektra, with incredible art from the regular series artist is Ron Garney, the colorist is Matt Mia, and then who's doing it. They really are giving the book this amazing signature look that I'm really happy with. And the artist for Issue 6 and 7 is Matteo Bafagni, who's an Italian gentleman who is knocking it out of the park. So the art on Daredevil is spectacular. The writing, I'm doing my best, what I can. I should also mention Phil Noto is drawing the Poe Dameron series, and again, he was born to draw Star Wars. It's great. And then the other big book I do for Marvel is Uncanny Inhumans, which is a big superhero swirling soap opera saga that's had a lot of great artists on it as well. Steve McNiven, Brandon Peterson, and Kev Walker is drawing the next several issues for us. So it's I'm really blessed with the art for sure. It's been wonderful. So and beyond that, what else? I know. I have a book called Strange Attractors that...
excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent book.
Thank you. It was originally published in sort of a small run in 2012, and Boom Studios, it was published through a company called Archaea, with art by Greg Scott, and it's going to be re-released by Boom, who now has the Archaea content, in a new single-issue format with a brand-new backup story that I'm working on with Sue Lee, who's another New York City-based artist. So if you don't know that book, Strange Attractors, it's about two geniuses who turn all of New York City into a gigantic machine in order to save it from a disaster. And I'm very proud of it. I'm happy that it's hopefully going to get out to a little bit wider audience. I think it starts coming out in June or July, and I hope people check that out.
Fantastic. So you're doing new backup stories for Strange Attractors?
Yes. There's an entirely new story in the... So Strange Attractors was originally about 5 issues worth of stuff. So those 5 issues will come out, and at the back of each issue is a new story that is designed to make the... sort of shed a new light on the original story that's in the book. It's called Antithesis, so it's Strange Attractors Antithesis. And the basic concept is that you have a... It's actually kind of complicated to explain if you haven't read the book, but it's designed to work really well as you're reading the book.
And hopefully all of our listeners have read the book.
Yes,
I've read the book.
True.
I recommended it on the show. I'm sure that they all got the one out of it.
I'm sure they did. But when you buy it in single issues and read it again, you will see that the one of the main conceits of the book is that you have an old professor of genius who loves New York City, and he tends to try to keep it running and keep it running smoothly and improve it by making tiny little adjustments to it in many different ways. So he'll break a street light to change traffic flows. He'll turn on a fire hydrant to help the mood on a hot summer's day. He'll just do all kinds of different little things. And he's been doing it since the late 70s, and he believes, maybe he's not, but he believes that those little changes through sort of complexity theory and mathematics have drastically improved life in the city. The new story, the antithesis story, suggests that even though he was making all of those improvements, there was someone in the city who all of that chaos had to be dumped on. So his life got drastically worse bit by bit by bit as the city got better. And it's kind of a sad story, what happens to that poor fellow and his life, and how it interrelates with the story that you read in Strange Attractors is, I think, really neat. And it's been neat for me to make the motivations of the original genius a little more complex, because he was saving the city, but he was really hurting this guy. So he didn't know it was happening, but nevertheless, what does that mean for him? So it's really cool. Subi is drawing great New York City artwork. I love it. And it's fun to go back into a world that I haven't really revisited for about 4 or 5 years. So it's really cool.
It's fantastic. All right. Buy all of those things.
Yes, buy all
also,
those things. Maybe 2 copies.
Also, Lando, which is collected.
Yes,
just
Lando.
Collected.
Obi-Wan and Anakin's coming out in collection soon. I think the first Daredevil collection should be out soon, and all kinds of stuff. I got a lot of books.
A bookstore near you.
Yep.
Charles, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
And thanks again to Charles for taking the time to speak with me at the show. Do grab all of his books, but especially Letter 44. It is such a cool story. Yes, there's a finish line in sight now, but we're still only 2/3 of the way through this epic tale that he's telling.
I had a friend of the show come up to me, and he had just talked to Charles Show Saul and told him that letter 44 was ending. Of course, this guy, knowing I'm a letter 44 reader, came to me in a panic and said, "It's ending. It's ending." I went into the panic and checked comic. It's ending at issue 35. And I didn't know off the top of my head what issue I was on.
That's right. There's only a year to go.
There's only a year to go. Man, I'm not used to this much notice. I don't know what to do with myself. So, you know, there's still two story arcs before the thing ends. So I think announcing this ending prematurely is...
it goes both ways, though. I mean, there is also a normal decay of readership on any comic. I mean, it's why we get these number ones from Marvel and DC and others, is that there's an entropy to comics buyers. Sometimes you say the issue 35 will be the end of the story, stick with us, and it shores things up. Sometimes that means people will say, "Oh, well, I'll just wait until it's all done then," which, you know, can destroy your sales. So it's risky, but on the other hand, I think I'm on the third or fourth the other hand at this point. Saying that there's going to be an ending for this story means that it's not going to be one of those runs that that they just dribble out and there's no real wrap up to it. They have the ending, they know what it's going to be, and they know when it's going to be.
Terry Moore has some really interesting blogs at terrymoore.com on that very subject, actually.
Oh, really?
Because of course his books with Strangers in Paradise and Echo, his books have his books drop in sales.
Mm-hmm.
And he hasn't had a natural ending, although I think all of his books end quite well. That he has to, you know, change things up.
Yeah, and I do wonder if he'll go into his next series with that in mind at this point, because Echo ran to, I want to say 40. Was it that's ballpark, right?
And that's ballpark.
And Rachel Rising will end at 42, and I know it. As he had said it with Rachel Rising, about halfway through, he said that the pattern was looking exactly like Echo, and if that kept up, that it would end, you know, around 40-ish. So I wonder if he would go into his next run thinking of a 40 issue story at this point after these experiences.
And you know, Strangers in Paradise is one of my favorite books. I will put it in anyone's. Now there's a first book for somebody. Put it in anybody's hands with great pride. But I have to wonder if he was writing to a 40-issue arc or something like that, if the book would not have been a little bit tighter.
Hmm. I think it's a fair discussion. I mean, it's the book does, I don't want to say drift, but how about digress from time to time?
Repeat itself, almost. But at the same time, I wouldn't trade any single issue for a tighter story. I love every issue. I'm just saying that maybe the story would have been a little crisper. I don't know.
It's a series I intend to get back to pretty soon. I've got all those. I've got the digest editions.
The manga format.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was my fourth buying of the series. So.
It's only my third.
Oh, really?
I didn't have the whole series, actually. I got those when I was getting back into comics after a long break, and Strangers had ended in the meantime. And so I'd never read the ending of it. So I started buying those so that I could read the finale of it. So
they are the best edition out at the time now. Although I now seem to be buying them digitally, so.
Well, there's a complete version, isn't there? Like there's a hardbound version that I think is a is the best version. But I've bought, well, the original miniseries I bought off the shelf when it came out. Mm-hmm. So I probably have bought those four times. And I may even have digital for the first issue or two. So I'm covered there. I've never read the ending of it. I've only read in this format.
Now, the hardbound. Have you ever sat down and read one of those hardbounds?
I have the Absolute Sandmans, and I've read those.
But have you read them in the hard?
Yeah.
That's a hard reading. I mean, it's hard to lay on your side and read that book.
Yes, I did read Absolute Sandman, and I read those copies. I would typically rest one side of it on a pillow, so that I didn't destroy the spine, but you know, could hold the weight of it. Yeah, they're not you don't read that one in the bathroom, that's for sure.
No, I mean, I do pick those up occasionally, and I always find I end up checking out the special features and then digging out my other copy of that, because by the time the hardcovers come out of anything monumental,
I
already own the issues.
Yeah, so. I have the Absolutes of Sandman because I didn't have a copy of Sandman. My collection got split up at a certain point, and it was when Brett and I were roommates. We only had one copy of a lot of different things, so that we could spend more money on comics. And so when we went our separate ways, I got Preacher, he got Sandman, I got Transmetropolitan, he got something else. So I didn't have any Sandman issues. So that was the deal with the Absolutes, is that I wasn't replacing anything, or wasn't like swapping out anything. I didn't have them at all.
Hmm.
Those are kind of the biggest ones that I have. Like, I've got Puma Blues was a tricky one. That's, you know, 400 pages hardbound. Again, reading it in short goes. All of those I read just one issue a day.
Mm-hmm.
Also stretching out those purchases.
I don't know why our theme seems that Chris can't store stuff. Whenever buying comics, I now think, where am I going to put that?
Mm-hmm. I'm having a lot of that. My bookshelf is very full. And
I'm trying
to enjoy less. Is what
Barry Windsor Smith storyteller. I know I'm not going to find them anywhere.
Thing.
But it's the stupidest size of a comic. I've also got rid of Rusty the Robot. True, it's Frank Miller, but it's not prime Frank Miller, and it's hard to store.
Well, and I've had to find a place for Rusty because I have that one signed by Jeff Darrow.
Oh, I mean, that's awesome.
So yeah, I'll have just a box somewhere that will have all these odd shaped books. That's what usually ends up happening to a comic fan, is you end up.
Yes, but even if they were even a standard size. Because I've tried the single box of the odd shaped stuff.
Yeah.
And the odd shaped stuff is not the same odd shape. So.
No, Storyteller is the worst. Storyteller is the worst size. At least Rusty is. Sorry. I'll caveat. Destroy by Scott Adams is the worst size. Because it's bigger than a treasury.
Just to let you know, if you've ever missed it. One of the best Superman stories ever, Scott McCloud, not Scott, McCloud. Scott Adams. Right. His Adventures of Superman have just been put out in trade.
Oh, neat.
Available digitally. Nice. So, something to look forward to there.
Keen. Scott McCloud. Scott Adams on comics. That'd be good, though. Let's get him doing some superhero stuff.
Say, Scott, I go the wrong one. Okay.
That's right.
Maybe you can refresh me on some We Talk Comics history, because we've done a couple hundred of these now, or 149, depending on your. Has Jeff Lemire been on the show?
We've never had him on the show.
We've always talked about.
Yeah, he's never come to the Calgary Expo. I met him just briefly at San Diego, the year that Underwater Welder came out.
Oh.
But no, we've not had him on.
We need to pump our Canadian comic book connections to get us in contact with Canadian treasure, Jeff Lemire.
You know, it's funny. When I was flying back to Halifax, so I read all of Sweet Tooth, and then I read The Mantle by Ed Brisson, and then I read a couple of a Ryan Ferrier mini as well. And I had this thought of, like, I could just read Canadian writers and creators, and I would be a happy guy. Like,
oh, I just finished Cluster for the second time, actually. Ed Brisson's Cluster.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And it's really good. Yeah. Really good. That and his Sons in Anarchy, which Brian Ferrier also wrote on. Mm-hmm. Oh, man, I love that. So, I'm iffy on the show, but that comic book is a number one.
I kind of half watched a lot of the show because my wife really liked it. So I'm wondering if I watched enough that I could understand the comic.
Oh, that's the beauty of the comic, actually, is especially Ed Brisson's run. He ignores... He picks characters, catches you up with what you need to know, and then that'll be the focus.
Right.
Some of the characters only had like two episodes in the series that they appear, but it's a 6-issue run in his arc. So
nice.
Yeah. No. I really like. If there isn't a bad Sons of Anarchy comic out there right now. That's ever been published. I really wish that series would pick up again, but nope. Boom, get on it.
I did do some shopping while I was in Halifax, and then PEI, my family all lives in PEI. I picked up a couple of interesting things, got some deals, and I feel I've done my part for comics. I found a copy of Eclipso, The Darkness Within, number one. This is the Bart Sears drawn Eclipso.
I know the one you're referring to,
with one of the greatest gimmick covers of all time.
Mm-hmm.
with a jewel, plastic jewel glued to the cover.
Yeah,
making it the most dangerous comic ever made. Guaranteed to destroy the adjacent comic. Go ahead.
Didn't they have a under 3 warning or something somewhere on that sucker?
Yeah, you'd think. I mean, it was only on with some like some paper glue. It wasn't. Well, I bought this. It was in a dollar bin, but it was bagged, and the jewel was loose on it. The jewel was just that's actually why I picked it up. Is the jewel was just in the bottom of the comic bag. So I bought it. I brought it home. I've done some restoration on it. This comic is back for another 20 years of destroying comics in dollar bins everywhere.
Oh, yeah. I have a hard time thinking of a worse gimmick cover. And I mean, there's been a lot.
There are so many. That's the one thing I've thought about pulling out of dollar bins, but you actually don't see them. Gimmick covers, because they were so targeted toward people who would never get rid of comics for cheap prices, you don't actually find them in dollar bins. Because there's a bunch I would pick up if I saw them in like a dollar or a $4 bin, I would grab them. Like the hologram Spider-Man covers. Mm-hmm. Spider-Man had so many stupid covers.
The hologram X-Men covers were the ugliest, though. I hated those things.
Oh, that's right. The which crossover was that? Was that Phalanx that had or was Phalanx the metallic covers?
Oh, what? They were both god awful.
Oh,
they?
Fatal Attractions. Fatal Attractions. That was the holograms. Yeah. And Phalanx had a metal foil or something on it.
Is it sad I now miss them?
I miss the creativity of them. Like, I miss the, you know, like when we had the guys from Malibu on, they were talking about the gimmicks. Yeah. Like, I miss gimmicks that had some creativity to them. Just variants. I don't care about variants. You know, give me a piece of plastic glued to the front of your cover. Give me a bullet hole.
Die cut the entire comic.
That's right.
Number one.
Cut issues. Yeah. Like, do something interesting.
Cause those store well.
Oh yeah.
They don't damage the government.
Oh, like the Wolverine number, was it Wolverine number 50 that had the slash marks on it? Was just like every copy was destroyed when it was sitting on the shelf.
Yeah. Oh, how about this one didn't damage anything, but it was one of my worst. I hated the Vision Bronze mm-hmm. Avengers cover.
Yeah, there were a couple of those covers that hurt your eyes because Fantastic Four had an all red one, and I think they had an all white one. But yeah, you had to hold it up to the light to try to figure out what the name of the book was because it was all just pressed into the paper.
And of course, I now see them they've digitized them, and
it loses somewhat. Yeah, it doesn't quite do the same thing digitally. I've been waiting for someone to really nail digital variant covers.
You know it's coming.
Yeah.
And I'm actually really looking forward to our first animated covers. Sparkly covers. I mean, sparkly can be done digitally, I think.
Yeah, like do a random download that every time you open the comic you get one of two copies. They've got different endings.
Since iOS seems to want to update every second day. I don't mind Comixology updating with the new software patch.
All right, we need the gimmick covers. We can come back. All right, well, let's wrap this thing up. We talked for it must have been seconds about the expo itself.
Yes.
How many screamers did you end up having?
Okay. I didn't like it. I did not like my first screamer.
Oh.
And I couldn't come out to Mo because if you know our buddy Mo, he lives for screamers. I did not want to be excised, but on a whole, I thought it's ice cream and a Slurpee, and I'd rather have ice cream and a Slurpee.
for those
not in the same cup.
For those who don't know, a screamer is Slurpee or slushy. Layered with soft serve ice cream. So it's kind of like it's Slurpee plus a milkshake, basically. And Chris had never had one. Chris will not be having another one, I guess. I had four over the course of the weekend. I did have one every day. They taunted me when I started, though, because they gave me a punch card and said, when you get, like, once you've purchased five, you get a free one. I'm like, but I'm here for 4 days. Like, am I going to go through six of these? That seems a bit much. I mean, five didn't seem that ludicrous, but six. that was convention fuel for me. That's what kept me going.
Mo had quite a few, so.
Mo usually makes up the average.
Yes.
All right. Well, stay tuned to We Talk Comics for some more convention content. We've got a couple of panels that are going to come up as separate episodes. We do have the return of our script panel, which we did last year and we've done as an episode of the show. This year featuring two different Batman scripts and Green Arrow Supermax. We had a ton of fun, a ton of laughs. And also the panel with Ryan Ferrier and Rove will be up. All right. Let's wrap this up, Chris. Say your goodbyes.
Goodbye. Join us at the show, man. It's going to be so much fun. And there's so many talented people going to be there. You're really going to miss out if you miss this weekend in Calgary. Fly in. I would do it.
Absolutely. You cannot stay at my house.
No.
Unless...
Matt! Okay. Matt St. Griffin, I'm sure, could stay at your house.
Matt can stay at my house. Ed Brisson could stay at my house. Jeff Lemire could stay at my house. That's it.
You wouldn't let Charles Soule into your house?
He's not a Canadian, man. That's...
So? Are you saying all Americans?
I would recommend a nice hotel for Charles Soule. He's got the big daredevil money. He doesn't have to sleep on my couch.
Yeah. Keith from We Talk Comics doesn't like Americans. He thinks they steal stuff.
That's just experience. All right. Like us, follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and subscribe to We Talk Comics on iTunes. With that, we are OUT.